You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster Talk is supported by listeners like you. Find out how you can contribute via Patreon or with reviews at monstertalk.org/support. Your contributions, large or small, make a huge difference. Thanks.
Welcome to Jurassic
Snark.
Quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
25 years ago, a movie about dinosaurs set a new standard for digital visual effects and introduced many people to revolutionary changes in our understanding of dinosaurs that had been transforming the way they were visualized. That movie was Jurassic Park, and it spawned sequels that are still making money and thrilling audiences today. But the movies have not continued to incorporate the latest science. And we're not here to indict them for that. Movies like these are made to generate revenue, not to educate. But to celebrate this 25th anniversary, friend of the show, Dr. Darren Naish of the Tet Zoo podcast and tetzoo.com blog, posted a lengthy stream of Twitter trivia about the movie with the hashtag Jurassic Park Trivia. I'll put a link to some of that stuff in the show notes. They're a treat. Also, this very weekend, if you happen to be in London, you could attend the 5th annual Tet Zoo Con, a convention about tetrapod zoology and the culture around Darren's popular blog and podcast. I'm sad that I can't go myself, but I wanted to give a hand to Darren in promoting it as well as I could, and also to get a chance to nerd out with him about dinosaurs and movies. So I hope you enjoy the talk we're about to have. An extended cut of this interview with a rather curious tangent is available for Patreon supporters at any level at patreon.com/monstertalk.
Monster Talk.
Hello.
Ahoy, ahoy. Yeah. Oh, we're doing video. Okay, hold on a second.
I don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, I won't record the video.
I found it useful to get visual signals from people when they speak.
Is that right?
Well, sometimes, you know, you can...
Because you're going to get a giant mic for visual from me. Let's see.
there's frequently a delay, which means you know, if you can see the other person moving, or if there's an emergency and they do some kind of like weird hand gesture or whatever.
For the listeners at home, he's doing a weird hand gesture.
Yes, kind of thing.
This is isn't it nice to have this giant obscuring mic? Although, you know, let's be fair, we're both old enough that the idea of having video conference calls was the future. And now, like every device, I have a piece of tape over the camera.
Likewise, yeah.
I thought the future I'd be, you know, sexier. I don't know what happened to me.
No, it's a good look.
Yeah, all right, thank you. Yeah, yeah. Redneck in his basement, in his natural habitat. I'm like, yeah, just like, what would David Attenborough say if he could see me now?
Well,
like,
you got a lot of books, so you get it.
I do. Not as many. I've seen how you've been developing your library. By the way, this is great content we're putting together here. I like this. So this is good. Okay.
It's what the listeners want. You know it.
All right. So thank you for coming back to Monster Talk.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a while.
Yes, well, yeah, I've always enjoyed previous appearances on the show, so yeah, thanks for having me.
And this is technically the first time we've actually appeared to each other, I think, on the show, so yeah, that's kind of weird. So let's get started on the questions, if that's all right. First of all, let me say, welcome back to Darren Nash. It's been more than a year since you've been on the show. And in that time, you've had some changes in what you do. But basically, I would identify you as a paleontologist and a science writer. Can you tell people about your science writing and the change in venue and what's going on?
Well, I'm best known, I guess, for Tetrapod Zoology, the blog I host, which I was based at Scientific American, which was, you know, good company to be associated with, but really wanted to become independent for various reasons, some of which I've kind of written about a little bit, and I've actually done that, gone independent. And Tetrapod Zoology, who cares if you write a blog? You know, who cares? who reads blogs these days? But it's part of this, it's kind of the core of an entire kind of media empire franchise that I and colleagues have built, which involves obviously the Tetrapod Zoology podcast, various books that come off the back of it, Tetrapod Zoology books and books about various other things I'm interested in, including cryptozoology, including dinosaurs and so on. And of course, the convention, TetzooCon, which at the time of writing, speaking even, is imminent. Yes, it's in a few days.
It's this weekend, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 6th and 7th.
So I will see to it that this episode gets out this week in advance of that. Yeah. So where is TetzooCon? Because I know a lot of American listeners will be discouraged by the drive.
Yeah, sorry, Americans. Yeah. It's in London, England. And it's always been in London. This is the first one that's 2 days, so it's unusual. It's a 2-day event. And we're in central London. And we just because that's where most of the people are, you know, you're being based in London, you've automatically got, you know, an audience on your doorstep of millions of people. So, but we've got a gathering of people from, you know, all across the Tetzooniverse, as we like to say, and you know, people research on animals living and dead. And I would like absolutely anything that's related in some way to the world of zoology, but specifically zoology of tetrapods, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals. As you know, that does include anything kind of sort of in the world of the media. Like, for example, this year we've got someone giving a talk about the making of music for nature documentaries, which is really interesting. Anyone involved, anything like that, anything to do with art that's related to natural history and zoology, anything to do with folklore, cryptozoology, big fan of cryptozoology, as you know. So any of those things would be at home. And with two days worth of talks, workshops, events, panels, it's difficult for me to remember everything that is happening. Sure. But it's
and vendors.
Yes. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Lots of people selling, several book signings, various vendors selling merchandise of various kinds, like, you know, artwork, also stuff like, you know, T-shirts and mugs and that. What I really would like is toys. I'm a big fan of animal toys and would really want, to have like a vendor bring in loads of toys. But it's just really hard to get people to move stock around because it's just not worth it for the amount of money they make at that. Conventions.
Well, you're promoting science and people will want to get T-shirts and books. So I'm excited for you. I wish I could go. It looks like a lot of fun and educational.
So, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, but not so educational that it's not fun.
Well, it's that middle ground. It's fun and you're learning whether you like it or not, or whether you realize it or not. And I think it totally works. Yeah.
Outstanding. Well, that's cool. How many years have you been doing it? There's several. Is this your fourth?
Now this is the fifth, which I
fifth?
Yeah,
wow,
yeah, I only realized that like 3 days ago, so I'm like, that's not as big a deal as having your 20th or your 10th, but it's still a big deal. Wow, we've been going for 5 years, a hemi decade. So
I mean, you should be, you know, potty trained by now at least, right? as far as
you'd hope. So we're celebrating it in some way. I run it together with paleo artist John Conway. Conway's a bit of a slacker, doesn't really pull his weight, doesn't really do much, but he is doing something in the way. I don't know what he's doing. I think he's making a banner or he's stapling some pictures together or something to say, wow, 5 years. So
that's very cool. Congratulations on that. So it, around the time that you decided to change your home base for your blog, I saw that it sort of coincided with you writing about Jurassic Park and the 25th anniversary.
Mm.
So So I'm bringing you back for what I'm calling a special episode, Jurassic Snark. So, and of course, you know, I think we both love the movie, but it's got its issues. So, but before we get into all that, let's talk about, when did you first see it?
On opening night when it came out in July. I think it was about July 12th, 1993, I think. The premiere here in England, or in the UK, the whole of the UK, was about 2 or 3 weeks after, certainly the US, so, and I guess the whole of North America got it. So yeah, we had a slight lag. So there was a lot of stuff in the press talking about it and talking about the premiere and everything in the States. But, July 1993. So I saw it the day it came out.
Where were you in your education at that point?
So I was, I'm not going to do the maths, but I reckon I was late teenage years. So I was at college. I was studying what we call A-levels, which are like, you know, beyond, oh my God, it's like before university, kind of like college, basically, yeah. Yeah, I was at college. And, yes, got to see all of the merch, like, due to my, I had a job at the same time as being in education, and was involved in the news agents industry, so dealing with magazines and newspapers all the time, and just, it was just constant Jurassic Park merchandise and promotion. So you're getting to see and hear all these snippets of the story long before anything has actually come out. So I already felt that, you know, I knew what a lot of things were going to look like. Obviously, I already knew Michael Crichton's book very well. What, you know, wondering what of the book is going to make it into the film. So going into the cinema for the first time, it's like, yeah, I kind of feel like I know some of it, but there's huge sway. So this general storyline, you don't know exactly what they're going to do in the storyline. But I feel it worked out.
I think they did okay. They did okay with it. Yeah. Financially, at least. But I guess what that tells me is probably as you went through your educational process, you became more and more educated about what was wrong with the film.
Ooh, how do I answer that? I don't know, because I would say that. So my concern before seeing the film, this might sound odd, but I was concerned that many of the strange things in the book were going to make it into the film. So Michael Crichton, I don't know. It's one of those weird things where I would say that he's good at coming up with stuff. If you think of, you know, the projects he's famous for, Westworld, Andromeda Strain, Jurassic Park and others, you know, he's good at coming up with these ideas, but the execution maybe isn't, you know, the best. And some of the things he puts in are really strange. There's also this weird kind of, you know, slight anti-science rhetoric that's in some of his writing, which is quite possibly linked to his views, which, you know, became well known under President Bush Jr., his views on anthropogenic global warming. He seemed to be somewhat anti-science in some regard, and there's quite a bit of that in Jurassic Park. It's like science is not for the good of us. We're not doing this to improve ourselves. We're doing it because of egos, and people like making a mess of things, is specifically said in Jurassic Park. So that was always weird, and that bothered me. And then the portrayal of some of the dinosaurs, just his ideas. Okay, we all get, I think you don't have to be an expert on prehistoric animals to know that there's, if we did bring any fossil animal back to life, there's going to be some aspects of its biology, appearance, behavior that, you know, we wouldn't have guessed that it did that or looked like that. But some of the things that he just has are just like, no, that's just silly, that's just wrong. I mean, there's a long list of examples in the book Jurassic Park, and the classic one is Tyrannosaurus has got a giant floppy slobbery tongue that it uses to like envelop people's heads, and it's why would you do that? Is that because the animal's meant to be some genetic chimera? Well, no, I think he thought that let's just have that as a weird thing. So stuff like that had me concerned about, like, maybe the film is going to be super weird. It's going to have some stuff in it that I really wish it didn't. I think it's quite obvious that if you drill down into some of the minutiae of specific things he says, you know, where did he get this from? He gets virtually everything he says from publications like New Scientist, which is fine, and there's no shame in that. But he's often just reading the superficial first take on something and not go into the technical papers. He's not really, you know, getting into these things in depth. And I remember the sex switching West African Hyperolid frogs as a brief news.
Who doesn't?
Exactly. We drink it in with our mother's milk, as they say.
Later, our fathers. Yeah. What?
To go back to your original point, it was. Do we need to be concerned about the way dinosaurs are being portrayed in the film? And when you see them finally in the film, see them for the first time, you know, like a lot of people of my age and people that like the film, people that like dinosaurs, I saw the film many times when it first came out, seen it many times since. And it's like, this is pretty good. They've done pretty good in terms of their portrayal of the dinosaurs. They haven't done everything exactly as I would have liked, but they have done pretty well. So, yeah, fears allayed somewhat.
Well, did you... I know recently you did a lot of tweets around this topic with trivia and stuff. Have you storified those into a single sort of one place I can send listeners to check that out?
No, I don't think I've done anything useful like that. No, but
yeah. That'd be really cool.
Let me write that down because that'd be a good thing to do. I'll check that out. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. In the meantime, though, they could just go back. I think you gave it a hashtag, if I remember correctly, though.
I think hashtag Jurassic Park trivia. Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be able to find it that way. That'll work. So what did they get right? What's good about the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park?
Yeah, so you've got to remember the film's made 1992, 93. To the majority of its audience, it's the first outing for the agile, active, you know, air quotes, warm-blooded and I don't have a problem with dinosaurs being warm-blooded. I just mean I don't like the term because it implies you're either warm-blooded or you're cold-blooded, and it's more complex than that. But it's the first outing for this like new look, horizontal bodies, tail off the ground, active running dinosaurs that are moderately intelligent. Okay, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, you know, definitely in cases, you know, way more intelligent than they probably were in life. But whatever. Yeah, it's the dinosaurs of the dinosaur renaissance. Or Renaissance, which are, you know, they've been around to scientists, the people who know dinosaurs, they've been around since the late 60s, but there is still this dominant trope that dinosaurs are, you know, the dinosaurs of Fantasia, the giant fat tail dragging, you know, cold blooded, dim witted reptile. And Jurassic Park is bringing to its audience the dinosaurs of the Renaissance. But it's a couple of decades late, but nevertheless, that's what it's doing. So that's a big deal. And it's doing it pretty well. You know, the Tyrannosaurus looks pretty good. The sauropods, the brachiosaurs, they're pretty, you know, accurately portrayed, and limbs are a bit too chunky, but, you know, they look good. And most people, you know, again, talking about the average person, not people who are not dinosaur fans, they haven't heard of Velociraptor. But okay, there's the disclaimer that the dinosaur in Jurassic Park is not Velociraptor, but they haven't heard of that kind of dinosaur before. That's a totally new animal to them, and that those kinds of animals, those you know, bird-like, agile, active, you know, vicious, sharp-clawed predators. Were a big deal that helped overturn people's understanding of what dinosaurs were like in the 60s and 70s.
As far as warm-blooded, cold-blooded, so you're saying they're not, they don't identify as thermally binary.
the thing is that, it's not a black or white distinction.
I've read a little bit about that because I guess some are thought to have been like apatosaurs. That would have been like their sheer body mass would have made them thermally warm-blooded-ish.
I mean across animals in general. I mean, animals in general, it's kind of bad to use this idea that you're either warm-blooded or you're cold-blooded. It's just not that simple. So there's, you know, there's mammals that have got, you know, a fairly active metabolism, they're generating heat internally, but they're still dependent on external heat. And there's
my wife, what She needs a blanket and a heater all the time. Is that what you're talking about?
I specifically had her in mind. That kind of thing. And you know, there's conventionally cold-blooded animals that are meant to be dependent on external sources of heat. There's various, you know, fishes and lizards that generate heat internally. And it's just like a bad way to think about animals. They're either warm-blooded or cold-blooded. I think gotcha. That most of the evidence we have for non-bird dinosaurs, extinct dinosaurs, I think most of the evidence indicates they probably were, air quotes, warm-blooded. It's just it's misleading to think that you're either warm-blooded or cold-blooded.
I think the phrase I've been going with is it's more complicated than that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's always more complicated than that, because anything you think you understand, chances are it's more complicated than that.
Exactly. He's like, there you go. And it's complicated enough that you don't want, you know, just avoid it. It's like,
probably an entire episode by itself, right?
So, exactly.
I mean, we're not even talking about Bigfoot here yet. So what did they get wrong? I mean, this may take longer.
Well, the key thing, of course, get it out there up front, not a surprise these days, is feathers. They opted not to feather their velociraptor-type dinosaurs. So the dinosaur in Jurassic Park, they call it Velociraptor. It's not actually Velociraptor. It's another animal called Deinonychus, which was, you know, discovered in Montana. But they called it Velociraptor because Crichton followed one particular author who said that Velociraptor and Deinonychus are the same animal. And so they included the older name, right? They gave it the older name. That turns out to be wrong. So it's not Velociraptor, whatever. Those Velociraptor-type dinosaurs, they decided to keep them scaly-skinned because the consensus in the paleontological community at the time was that was more likely to be correct. That was kind of, you know, more sensible, more conservative. And that has had knock-on effects, you know, all the way up to the current films, the Jurassic World films, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, obviously the newest one. Now, as I've said a few times, I say this in my Tetrapod Zoology articles about Jurassic Park. There were people in the early 1990s and beforehand, you know, going back to the 60s, there were people who said that these velociraptor type dinosaurs probably should be given feathers because their anatomy is so similar to that of their close relatives, early birds. The most famous example, of course, being Archaeopteryx, which has been known since the late 1850s. So they should really have feathered them, but general consensus among paleontologists was don't. And of course, well, look where we are now. Now we know for sure these animals had feathers because we've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fossils of them preserved that way. So that's the biggest, you know, thing. They should have put feathers on them, and they didn't.
And then I think I always found it like early on interesting, before even the feather thing came to my attention, was the DNA breaks down. So the whole idea of getting the DNA from mosquitoes, which I thought was super clever when I saw it. But later on when I was reading about it, it's like, oh, DNA doesn't last that long. I mean, it lasts a lot longer than I thought it would based on recent things people being able to extract. But apparently it's no good. And also, that they never explain in the movies how they get things like a mosasaur. That seemed what mosquito was biting that?
I'm not worried about that because mosquitoes bite crocodiles and whales all the time. So you could get there's no reason why you couldn't get the DNA from marine animals. You know, there are mosquitoes on beaches and stuff. But yeah, if there's anything in there that requires to use that infamous phrase suspension of disbelief, it's that. It's just the idea that they just managed to you know, of the length of the DNA strand, as you've mentioned, you know, it doesn't last more than a, you know, at best a few tens of thousands of years, and yet they're talking about retrieving near complete DNA strands that are millions and millions of years old, at minimum 66 million years old, or technically 65.5 million years old, and they're just repairing the gaps somehow. Quite how they know where the gaps are and have the, I don't know. It's, yeah, no, yeah. But so that's the bit that just requires you to just wave your arms. Yeah, yeah. They just that's just how it works. And also, why would you get dinosaurs that you know? It's like, of the list of animals that they reconstituted from these, you know, recovered bits of genomes, how come they've ended up with all the famous species? How come they haven't got when they've got a load of things that we've never heard of that are totally new? I think that's been mentioned a few times. That would be more
like... It seems like, based on the fossil record, they'd be disproportionately high in hadrosaurs, right?
I mean, yeah.
Everything's
yeah.
a hadrosaur.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
What else have you got? No, that's it.
No predators? No. only 10 samples. Oh, great. Yeah.
So, what... You have been working with a project in England that's trying to get some of this stuff more accurately. What can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so this is Dinosaurs in the Wild, which is kind of like the modern version of Jurassic Park. Although, sorry, a bit of a spoiler here, it's not actually real. It's
what?
Yeah, sorry. It's sort of. Not, you know, it's not connected in any way to the Jurassic Park, Jurassic World franchise, of course, but it's sort of the logical descendant of it, in that you, should say from the start that it's now closed. It closed on 2nd of September this year.
Sorry, listeners.
Sorry, yeah. But the idea was that you would step in a time machine, that there's a company called Chronotex, which has invented time travel and is using it to explore the past, and they've set up research bases at various points in history. You go to Time Base 67, and you explore a research base where there's people doing experiments and dissections and studying animals in laboratories and all that kind of stuff for all kinds of different purposes, you know. And you do get to see through a lookout, you know, through big windows, which aren't really windows, they're actually screens, again, spoiler. You get to see CG dinosaurs. And I was the technical consultant on this, and... they're pretty much the among the best CG dinosaurs yet created, and certainly by far the best for something of this kind of thing, you know, for a visitor attraction in London. It only ran for 13 months in three different locations in Birmingham, Manchester, and London. It was only visited, these figures are, you know, not bad. It was visited by over a quarter of a million people and scored really highly in terms of visitor feedback and, you know, the sorts of feedback you expect from, you know, when the way it scores as goes how like attractions are scored. And really, really happy with what people said about it. And so it was late Cretaceous, Western North America. It's meant to be set in Montana because it's based around you seeing animals like Tyrannosaurus and Triceratops. We kind of figured you had to have those like superstar animals to draw people in. But we did the sort of things that something like Jurassic Park and Jurassic World maybe should have done but didn't. So, you know, we got good looking, accurate, colorful, often feathery dinosaurs. Our tyrannosaurs are fuzzy. They do have like filaments on parts of their bodies. Our Dakota raptor, which is a large relative of Velociraptor, fully feathered, very bird-like. Our giant sauropods and our triceratops are very extravagant, weird-looking, brightly colored animals. And we include some non-dinosaurs, like the giant pterosaur Quetzalcoatlus, which myself myself and colleagues have argued that was a, you know, quite different from the conventional portrayal. It wasn't some super light air being that relied on grabbing things while in flight. It actually was quite a robust, muscular kind of animal that walked around on the ground and grabbed things, things up to the size, you know, like human-sized animals. So, an exciting new...
Human size, but not humans, because they didn't coexist. Just...
Thanks for clearing that one up.
That was not for you, Darren. That was for listeners.
What are you saying about your listeners, Blake?
I love them is what I'm saying. So.
Yeah.
Oh, so that sounds awesome. So was it a commercial project, an educational project? How was that created?
It was a commercial project. So it's run by a consortium led by, that's not fair, but I always, it's led by a whole bunch of people. It's difficult for me to kind of pin it down to like, you know, one company, because the company was called Dinosaurs in the Wild. But I first got involved in it because of Tim Haines, and Tim Haines is the guy behind Walking with Dinosaurs and similar projects. So it kind of evolved out of that. Of course, Tim's not the only person involved. Loads of people helped to bring this to life.
Has he thought about like a Chinese food show, Walking with Dinosaurs?
I have to be so careful in listening to what you say, because I sometimes, you know, I miss these gentle.
If Jack Horner has his way, the chicken will soon become part of that project.
Oh dear. Yeah, how do you feel about that project?
Turning a chicken into a more a primitive version by unlocking chunks of DNA that nature thought were not needed anymore.
Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong? No, we talked to a guy who teaches at a university near me, and part of his project was, you know, turning on the gene for chicken teeth, you know.
Mm.
And I was like, and then what happens? Well, we kill them while they're embryos, and then look at it under a microscope. I'm like, you don't grow chicken teeth? Why would you not do that? He's like, well, ethics prevents it. And I'm like, well, I feel like my tax dollars are wasted is what I feel like.
As a fan of chickens, I've got mixed feelings about it. I kind of can't help feeling that it's, I don't know. Chickens are quite magnificent animals, and you're not going to produce some magnificent, beautiful thing. It's going to be some fairly ugly kind of cobbled together Frankenstein.
Well, you heard it here, folks. Paleontologist cries foul.
Yeah, I've already done a few terrible cartoons of what I think Jack Horner's Chickensaurus will look like online.
I don't know. My grandfather once found a roaming emu. Or emu, I'm not sure. I always say emu, but
it's fine.
I don't know why, but it was on his property, and he has like 300, more than 300 acres. He calls a neighbor up, and the two of them wrestle this emu, and they put it into a pen, and he keeps it for 10 years.
Hmm.
So I've had about 10 years of experience with an emu, and honestly, the idea of a chicken rolled back to its most predatory, primitive state, you know, seems a little scary. I mean, obviously chickens, I don't know what it would take within their DNA to find size, you know, but turning on the scales, turning on the teeth, this kind of stuff, they already have pretty scaly feet. Their feet, you know, look, I mean, well, to be fair, the emu look more like a dinosaur, you know, than anything. And I guess technically they are dinosaurs.
That's right. All birds are dinosaurs. Yeah. Right. And they're not talking about, I mean, remember the kind of dinosaur, the kind of non-bird dinosaur that they're thinking about making their chicken resemble already kind of looks like a chicken anyway. All these, you know, velociraptor-type dinosaurs, they're called maniraptorans. Maniraptorans, the big group that includes the velociraptor-type things, the oviraptors, the troodontids, and the birds. The fossils show us they all basically look like kind of big chicken-y-type animals. So if you do actually, even if you trigger those genes that cause it to grow teeth and cause it to grow, you know, large clawed fingers, you're not going to see a lot of that stuff anyway, because you know the teeth are inside the mouth. The birds already have fingers, but they're concealed by the feathering. I'm just kind of confused as to what they think they're going to show. It's going to be a fully feathery animal. They're not going to, you know, turn it scaly, because the dinosaurs weren't like that. Those dinosaurs weren't like that. So
I was going to say, one of the interesting things about it though is how much of the information is still captured in the DNA, but it's not written out to express itself in whatever necessary moments of its, you know, development happen. And I find that interesting because I come from an IT background. So some of the complaints I have about Jurassic Park fall into Nedry's realm and the IT department. But the idea of finding out or having a better understanding of how to unlock segments of the genome that have been disabled for whatever reason because of evolution. I find that very interesting. You know, those genes that may still express themselves in other species but have been turned off in our species or other species that we're looking at. You know, and looking at the sort of molecular differences between close relatives over time. I think that all is probably going to be necessary. And as a species who's looking into understanding this, we just recently found out DNA exists, and then recently found out that every living thing we've run into has it. And then recently found out that genes have more than one way of expressing themselves. And there's this whole thing, about information outside of the genes and epigenetics. And so we're like in baby land. And so I guess the hubris of thinking they can take any animal and roll it back is a little bit ridiculous. But if you don't think big, maybe you don't discover stuff. So I don't know what'll come of it. I'm not against it. But I don't think we're going to see anything particularly, as you say, photogenic.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Yeah. Well, as off the back of this project, they have already discovered some really interesting things about Evo Devo, about how the genetics is linked to the development of certain bits of anatomy. They've published some stuff on the different parts of the snout, the way they're formed in birds and how that's different from how it was in other kinds of dinosaurs, how the fused tail in birds forms as opposed to the longer, you know, more segmented tail of other kinds of dinosaurs. But so those are interesting things that are worth knowing about. Knowing which genes code for the development of which structures. But yeah, that does not make a big difference to the overall look of the animal, which is the thing that people are most interested in.
We're kind of shallow.
yeah. But like I say, that's the thing. Even if you did have a live velociraptor, you know, velociraptor's not particularly big. It's like the size of a turkey. You wouldn't, you know, people want it to be some snarling kind of dragon monster, and it's not. These things would have looked like hawks or pheasants. They wouldn't be that spectacular. Hawks and pheasants are spectacular. I like them a lot, but I'm just saying, you know, it's not the vision of dinosaurs that people kind of think they will get.
Yeah. So let's change topics a little bit, because I want to catch something that was in the news recently, but a few years back, one of Jack Horner's colleagues, Mary Schweitzer, allegedly found soft tissue in a T-Rex skeleton. And it was a really big controversy at the time. And I had looked around before we talked and saw some suggestions that this was legitimate. But I thought I would check with you, because I know science sometimes pushes back and forth on these kind of questions. Have you kept up with that, and what's going on with that soft tissue research?
Well, it's beyond my area of expertise, and it's also, to be frank, it's beyond my direct area of interest. I don't particularly find it that interesting. Paleoproteomics, as it's known, but and as a non-specialist, it's quite difficult to know, you know, which way it's going, because it's one of those things where if you read the papers published on both sides of the fence, they both sound equally defensible and, you know, valid. So Schweitzer and colleagues, they say they've identified these specific proteins, these specific chemicals that are very similar to those of birds, but are in these, you know, Cretaceous ancient fossils. And they're saying they're not remarkable fossils, they're just ordinary dry chunks of bone. They also say not only do they have these chemical, you know, traces, but they have actual, you know, blood vessels and blood cells and so on. A few other teams have reported similar results, saying they found blood vessels and blood cells. And it's like, if they seem to have ruled out, Schweitzer and colleagues and the other people who've published this kind of research, they seem to have ruled out in their research that it's not fungi, it's not bacterial biofilms, you know, it's none of those things. And you're like, well, okay, maybe, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe there's something that we're not quite understanding. These fossils are not just bones that have been mineralized and have lost any organic content. The organic content is still in there. There's some part of the process that we still don't quite get. So I'm prepared to buy that. You know, I've met Mary Schweitzer on a couple of occasions. I've been to talks. I've read these papers. You know, I'm like, okay, you know, okay, that sounds pretty compelling to me. But then on the other hand, you've got people that say that no, they've made some fundamental mistake. They have mistaken, you know, they've misunderstood the chemistry. No one else can replicate their results. No one else is finding the same stuff as they are. And those people also seem to know what they're talking about. You know, these are people who publish, you know, on the same stuff, the biochemistry of fossils and microscopic, you know, biofilms and bacteria preserved in fossils and everything. And again, you know, I listen to their stuff and it's like, yeah, this is an appropriate level of skepticism for such a remarkable series of claims. So I'm totally on the fence on this one. My feelings won't be hurt either way, you know, whichever way it goes. And I'm inclined to think that it is valid because having seen Schweitzer et al's you know, results and heard how they've interpreted them and what they think they've seen, what they seem to have seen, it's like, yeah, that I find it compelling, but I also see it as it is weird, and surely there's got to be another explanation is kind of what my gut tells me. So and so far as I know, that is kind of where everyone is in the community right now. You know, every couple of years at the conferences, the paleontology conferences, there's one of these talks. You get someone says that, oh, yeah, we've shown that these blood vessels and blood cells, that they're you know, fungal spores or, you know, bacteria or something. And then you get someone else saying, well, we tested them and no, they have the specific chemistry that demonstrates they're from, they're from bird-like animals. And do not match fungi. They do not match bacteria. So, yeah.
So I don't want to oversimplify it or dumb it down or be wrong, terribly wrong, because I'm often all those things. but they found something in a cavity in the bone, right? And then it was somewhat spongy, and they demineralized it, and we're left with something kind of like collagen. Is that the idea?
That is the gist of one of these studies, but there's a whole bunch of them. So there's like about Schweitzer and colleagues have published, I had a guess like 5 to 15 papers where they've reported results just like what you've described, but others as well. So yeah, that's there's no. You're referring to the one where they dissolved the bone and they were left with some organic residue behind,
right,
and
that's
couldn't be explained unless it was actual blood vessels.
I mean, it's not wacky because, I mean, in theory, a live animal dies and then starts to slowly be mineralized. So the idea that there would be some organic material left behind throughout that process until it was complete makes sense. What I found more shocking was this recent Precambrian Dickinsonia fossils. And that's like 500 million years old, not 65.
Yeah.
And they're claiming that they found cholesterol molecules in those, which would, if true and not a contamination, would imply these were particularly animals and not fungi or some other animal life or some other life form.
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing to me that cholesterol is still a problem with fossils. And is there like a statin drug or something that we can give these fossils to help them?
Well, they're very flat fossils, so
they are.
They didn't bother them that much. But in that case, I mean, where you're talking about, I mean, remember that these kinds of cases, you're not talking about like a complex, you know, long chain fatty molecule thing. You're talking about like, you know, microscopic chemical traces that a total non-expert on any of this and haven't even read that new paper. But it's like, yeah, okay, if you find, you know, specific chemical traces that are linked to that particular, you know, chemical or whatever, then okay. It's fossilization is probably not, it's certainly not the things are turned to stone, that's the end of it. That's not the process. It's not things are turned to stone. It's proving to be way more complex. And we've always, like, you know, taught and been taught that it requires the most exceptional circumstances for organic traces to be preserved. It's looking really much the case that that is not so, that it's not that exceptional for, you know, it seems at the moment from everything we've just been talking about, it seems that a great many fossils do incorporate some organic content. And remember that what you just said about fossils being slowly mineralized is, like, that's not definitely the case. We know of modern taphonomic experiments, modern experiments done on living things, where they're mineralized really quickly, like in hours or days, due to the specific chemistry of the water they're in or the sediment that they're entombed in. There's actually cases where my former PhD supervisor Dave Martill did a load of things with certain shrimps in particular environments where they like mineralized at death just because the particular conditions of the solution they were in meant that was a thing that happened. So if that can happen, the whole idea that fossilization is meant to occur over a long period of time is absolutely not true. And the whole idea that organic aspects of an organism will be destroyed before the organism is entombed into the rock record is, you know, there's no reason to assume that. It's like things can happen much quickly.
Well, I would have to say that if we could figure out how to make that happen easily, we could completely transform the funeral industry. Because can you imagine, you could just be your own statue?
do you know about, this is quite a macabre subject, I don't know if we should talk about it, but you know, there are cases of, do you know what lithopedian is?
It's a rock that walks. I don't know. No, what is it? That's a lithopedestrian. Sorry. What is a lithopedian?
Lithopedian is like a calcified fetus that's embedded in the body of the mother, sometimes considerable.
Oh, I've seen them in Weekly World News. Yeah.
Weekly World News.
I mean, you know, I've seen them in fringe tabloidy kind of things. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
The sort of thing you would see at the, I think it's the Muter Museum.
Yeah.
Where they have like various abnormalities and various other things. But yeah, I had heard about sort of calcified fetuses. Yes.
Yeah, I think I should stop there because I got off on a very peculiar tangent.
Well, it is a tangent, but it's also October, so this could be Halloween content. Don't hold back on my account.
Well, it's also, it's one of those blind alleys where I know the fact that it exists, but I certainly don't know enough to talk about it on a podcast because you shouldn't make a fool out of yourself on a
podcast. I agree. I think what are the things that sort of elevate Monster Talk in from some podcasts, not yours, but some podcasts, is I do a modicum of research before I talk to people. So and I mean deeper than Wikipedia.
Right. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it.
So yeah, but that's all right. Nature is strange, and I know you've tried to limit yourself to tetrapods.
Mm.
You're really excluding a lot. Like, I looked at some Cambrian fossils, you know, the Cambrian explosion, and, you know, you think about, you know, we see, what, tetrapods and occasionally hexapods in the forms of insects, and then, you know, then there's creepy stuff like millipedes and centipedes, but, man, there was a lot of other body types out there that didn't make it. Maybe it's some that did, some that are under the ocean that are still out there that are just amazingly peculiar.
Well, yeah, this is a really interesting subject. It comes up a lot in discussions of the where do I start? I mean, it's the whole thesis behind Stephen Jay Gould's book Wonderful Life, the contingency of life, whether things are, you know, predetermined or destined, whether certain body plans will inevitably arise once you know, multicellular organisms have evolved. And Gould says, using the Burgess Shale animals of the Cambrian as an example, he says that there's all these crazy body types that never went anywhere. It wasn't inevitable that arthropods and chordates, which include vertebrates, it wasn't inevitable that they would arise and, you know, survive. Why wouldn't there be descendants of, you know, he mentioned some other animals as the representatives of very different body types. Why wouldn't there be opabinia descendants, things with, you know, proboscis and multiple segments and everything? And that's kind of relevant to some of the speculative biology stuff. People saying, oh, you know, if there were other timelines, parallel timelines, you know, you wouldn't have vertebrates, you would have, you know, whatever, some other lineage. The pushback to Gould's idea, which has been promoted most strongly by Simon Conway Morris, whose research Gould was mostly writing about, Simon Conway Morris said that Gould was flat wrong, and that these weird body types actually weren't that weird, and that they were all like stem members, like early members of the main lineages. So most of them are kind of like, you know, members of the arthropod lineage that were not that different from early arthropods that are better known from better remains. And that's turned out to be mostly true. I don't think that it in any way disrupts the Gould's main theme about complex life not having an inevitability in terms of, is it inevitable that you would end up with humanoids, you know, with five fingers and, you know, flat faces and walk like us? Is that inevitable? But Simon Conway Morris, you know, I think went too far as well in his book, because he seemed to have his couple of books. Because I seem to always end up talking about this on podcasts. I've done this a few times. He basically said that no. What happened? What was inevitable? It was inevitable there that humanoids would end up with five fingers and all that kind of stuff. And that
I used to get tandoori from a guy with six fingers, so I'm going to disagree. But yeah,
the fact that one of Conway Morris's books is called Crucible of Creation, and that it does seem to lean somewhat heavily on his religious convictions is, I don't know what the right term is, but it bothers me just a little bit.
It implies a potential bias.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah. So, and I wish Gould was still around, because he was a hell of a writer. And, you know, I didn't agree with everything he wrote, but I really enjoyed almost every article I read of his.
Yeah.
And he was a really good science communicator. And, you know, there's an interesting Monster Talk tie-in here. His widow got very excited about Hogzilla.
Huh.
Do you remember Hogzilla, the giant
very
pig?
Very well, yeah, I read about it, yeah.
Yeah. So she wrote some of the best debunking of the Hogzilla photos I saw.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's really, I don't know why, that, like, it didn't seem to tie in with any of her other stuff, but she got all over Hogzilla and wrote several articles about Hogzilla and some sort of the subsequent giant hog stories.
How bizarre.
I really ought to have an episode about Hogzilla, because pigs are weird. And delicious, but weird.
Yeah. Are pigs that weird? What's weird about pigs? I'm not saying you're wrong, but...
Well, here in Georgia and around the southeastern United States, you get to see what happens to the domestic pig as a phenotype when it goes feral.
Mm.
So you take a normal-looking regular farm pig, and you take it out and let it go into the wild. It'll survive just fine in America. There's plenty of food for it. In fact, it'll really thrive. There's big herds of them in Texas, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, probably Florida too, but I know in those states. And these wild hogs, their hair becomes extra coarse and long. They get big tusks. They basically turn into wild boars, only now they're 500-pound wild boars instead of 150-pound European boars. So they're impressive how quickly they change. And once they've changed, you can't take them back into the pen and have them turn back into normal pigs again, or like domestic looking pigs. That phenotypical change, whatever triggers it, is from a body type perspective, it is a stunning change.
So
I find that interesting.
I think that's interesting. Yeah, it seems to be very quick as well, of just a few generations and they revert to wild boar type looking animals. Yeah, we have the same thing here in Europe, because the wild boar was officially made extinct here in England in the, I think, as far back as the 1600s. But there's just been constant, you know, releases over the years, accidental and deliberate, of domestic pigs of various kinds, and some releases of boars as well. But you've ended up with this hybrid swarm of like bold suburban boars that, like, you know, dig up people's gardens and smash their cars and stuff. So yeah, there's parts of England, southern England, that have got, you know, they've just given up trying to control them. We obviously do not have the whole hunting culture that, you know, you do have in parts of the States. We just don't have that at all. There's like one or two people that might go out and, you know, with a license, cull a few deer every now and again. But these pigs, boars are out of hand in some places. And of course, we don't have any natural predators whatsoever. We don't have any of the stuff that you have. So unless we're going to go down the route of talking about the British big cats, but even if we do, I do think we do, at least at times we do have escapee pumas and leopards, you know, occasionally. But even if we do, you don't have a population that's going to be, you know,
not sufficient to keep that other population in control.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think pigs are like kind of like dogs. I think if people left, pigs and dogs would be fine. So they'd probably have a very interesting relationship with one another.
They can be friends.
they can eat each other too. They said, pigs are brutal. So my grandfather raised hogs, and so I got to see how hogs behave amongst themselves. And pigs are not nice. Pigs are brutal. Pigs will eat anything, including other pigs.
Well, they're very much like people.
They are. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I mean, people, you know, a lot of religions prohibit the consumption of pork. And, you know, a lot of modern people have decided that's because of disease and potentially because they competed for the same food. There's lots of reasons.
Mm.
They are delicious. I'm not arguing that. And, you know, I'm not a religious person, and I just can't imagine that if there was a God, he'd want me not to eat barbecue. But that being said, they are like, they can be very dangerous, and they do, like, you see how we use them in fiction, like between George Orwell and Pink Floyd. I think that we've got it covered there.
I'm impressed with how intelligent they are. I do like the fact that they're part of the even-toed hoof mammals, the artiodactyls, and it turns out that a group of animals that, you know, due to our own history and their history, the fact that they've mostly been, you know, grazing and browsing animals of woodlands and plains, we've seen them as, you know, nothing more than animals we should just hunt and kill. But it's like, once, now that we've got to know them through decades and decades, and in cases centuries of domestication, they're all like pretty smart. Pigs, certainly, you know, a pig is almost definitely as clever as a dog, if not smarter. I know not all dogs are of equal intelligence, but you know what I mean. And this is probably true for most artiodactyls. They're actually pretty smart animals. This even goes for sheep and goats. So we've got this idea that, you know, sheep are really stupid, brainless, you know, herd animals. But, well, sheep and goats are really similar, and goats do really well on intelligence tests. You know, again, way beyond dog level. There's a load of recent experiments about goats' response to human emotions, and goats are like experts at reading human facial signals. Seriously, check this out, it's amazing. They're like, you know, again, they're on par with other primates and with dogs. And I'm saying,
it's because their lord and master is Satan. Have you looked at their eyes, Darren?
I've looked into their eyes. Yes, everyone says this, but you know, no one says that about a horse. Have you looked into a horse's eyes? Because all those, you know, plains dwelling hoofed mammals, they've all got eyes like that. So yeah.
I don't remember horses looking like that. I've looked at a horse's eyes, but I don't remember it. Do they have the vertical eye slits?
Horizontal. Really? Horizontal.
Horizontal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but they have a bar. It's shorter in horses than it is in goats. But that's mostly because the eye is not as obvious. It doesn't, you know, it's not giant bulging thing out of the head.
So, we fell off dinosaurs somewhere. I'm not sure how that happened. I feel like alley-oop all of a sudden. That was a falling off dinosaurs joke. Thank you, people. But
I just about got it. I'm vaguely aware of who alley-oop is.
Yeah. It was an American comic strip when I was a kid. So it was old when I. It may have actually been paleo art. All right. I think we've covered most of the questions I had. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Jurassic Park, Jurassic World. Did you like the new one?
I haven't seen it because it just didn't like grab my interest, and it was on at the same time as a bunch of other movies that I was more interested in seeing.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I just.
Well, I thought it answered that question that almost everybody who watched Jurassic Park had, was like, okay, we brought dinosaurs back and we put them on an island. But what would it be like? Hold on. What would it be like if we also had them in a big fancy house? Because I know that's what I've been wondering about.
Yeah.
I mean, these are dinosaurs, maybe nature's most magnificent creatures ever created. Let's put them in a house.
Let's put them in a house. Yeah. I know there's, I've seen the bit in the basement, and I did see the giant Lego house, the Lego construction. So I know there's meant to be bits when the Indoraptor is Indominus is meant to be climbing.
Indominus, yeah.
See, climbing on the roof and stuff. So, yeah, I think I know what I need to, but I don't know. Maybe I'll see it when it goes to Netflix or something. But yeah.
My kids loved it. I'll say that.
Fair enough.
I don't want to speak ill of it because they had a good time, and someday they may listen to this show. Well, maybe they stopped listening somewhere around the pig sex.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Darren, I really wish I could be at TetsuCon. I think this is going to be a ton of fun and really educational. Is there anything else you want to talk about with TetsuCon? Remind people. I know it's in London. I know it's this weekend.
Well, not really. I mean, as it's the first 2-day one, and just getting it to 2 days is the threshold to like building something bigger and better. So ultimately, we want it to be a multi-day event. And if we do ever end up with enough money in the kitty, we have a big international audience. We have a big American audience. So we'd certainly be interested in going stateside and doing a TetsuCon West. So maybe one day if you're interested in stuff that I write about and the broader workings of what's in the Tetsuniverse. Yeah, you know, keep your eyes, keep an eye on what's going on, because it should get bigger and better over time.
That sounds awesome. I keep an eye on this, because someday I'd love to do a monster conference that's more skeptically oriented.
Mm.
And so I'm always interested in how people fare when they try to put together conferences like this. So I'm watching it closely.
Well, thanks. Thank you. We wanted to do, we've got an on-stage debate this year. It's turned out not a debate at all. It's turned into just a friendly discussion, but I initially wanted it because I thought that could be a good chance to have, you know, friendly arguments of the sort you might have with, about such subjects as Bigfoot and lake monsters and so on. And I'm sure in time we will get to that. We will have a specialist sort of, cryptozoology or mystery animal section. We've had a few talks, but we haven't had a devoted session. And that's definitely something we're going to have soon. Yeah.
Okay. But we'll put the website will have all the details.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
And I'll have that in the Monster Talk notes at monstertalk.org as well. Okay, so tetsu.com.
Yep.
Okay. And then monstertalk.org. There we go.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. You've been listening to an interview with Darren Naish about Jurassic Park and the science behind that film. Darren's fifth annual TetsuCon is October 6th and 7th, 2018, in London at the venue on Mallet Street. Links to that will be at the show notes at monstertalk.org or at tetsu.com/convention. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, and the views expressed here are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Honestly, I don't know if they have any opinions about Jurassic Park. You'd have to check the magazine. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rabb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psiconference.org.
Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. As always, thanks for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
These wild hogs, their hair becomes extra coarse and long. They get big tusks. They basically turn into wild boars.